I love asking the question, what TV series are you watching right now of friends of mine? I like hearing the responses, and sometimes if the shows are the same, it gives us opportunity to talk about those and have some conversation, actually even look forward to future episodes. Well, one of my favorite all-time TV series was Gilligan's Island, 1964 to 1967. Now, don't get the wrong idea. I only watched reruns, so don't start aging me up here. But it was fantastic. Loved it. Well, in season three, a guy named Dr. Boris Belenkov, if you used to watch the show, you're going to know who this is, lived on a faraway island with his monkey, and twice as the show ran, went to Gilligan's Island to put all of the castaways under a mind control for different reasons. Well, the second time in season three, he went back to do that because he wanted them to rob Fort Knox. So they had this cart that they made. Again, no power, no lights, no motor car, not a single luxury, right? That's if you know the song. Had this car that somehow they got pedal push to work. And so they were practicing robbing Fort Knox. Of course, what were they using instead of gold? Coconuts. So they had the coconuts in the back. They had mind rings on them. If they saw anything shiny and out of the ordinary on the island, they put those on. And so through the mind rings, Boris would tell them what to do. And they would always say, "I hear and I obey." That's what happened. And so at the end of the show, somehow that mind control device got hit with the coconut, smashed, and they all woke up. Where were they? They were down by the lagoon, who, of course, Dr. Boris had his motorized boat and took off. They, once again, disappointed, discouraged. The whole built was around, the show was built around the castaways getting away, getting off the island, and once again, there goes another motorized boat. Fascinating story, isn't it? If you have not seen that, I encourage you to. As great parents that Tiffany and I are, we actually watched that TV series during dinner until we finished the whole series. So I don't know how you feel about watching TV and dinner. Hold on just a second. Excuse me. That thing has been sitting there all day. All right. I think I just got it. You knew you came to listen to that. That's terrific. So in some respect, in Galatians, that was what was happening to that people group. Verse 1 of chapter 3, let's just read it. Paul says, "O foolish Galatians, who has bewitched you? It was before your eyes that Jesus Christ was publicly portrayed as crucified, bewitched, mesmerized, entranced, just as the castaways were with their mind rings. They couldn't recognize, see, or hear any voices other than Dr. Boris's. You could have put your hand in front of their face and waved it multiple times. No reaction." Well, that was what Paul was experiencing with the Galatians. He repeatedly told them up to this point in the letter, "Wake up. You are being bewitched. You're focused on a wrong gospel. You've changed it. You've altered it. You're missing the point." Yet as many times as Paul had said it, they still weren't getting it. So Paul continued with a reasonable argument. He wanted the spell to be broken. And in verses 1 through 5, in helping the Galatians see why their actions were foolish, that they were contradicting the cross, and therefore the opportunity to recognize what had taken place in their lives already, when they surrendered, thank you, John, once again, I appreciate it. John's always saving us. John, we appreciate it. He brought me water. I'll just take a second. Is that okay? I owe you one. Thank you. We'll keep that up there because I'll kick it over. Thank you. He was trying to bring them to their senses, trying to get them back together, trying to help them recognize where they were, that they were being fooled instead of embracing the cross and killing off their independent, self-reliant, and subordinate selves. They were forgetting the reality of what had taken place in their lives. So in altering the gospel, they eliminated the need for grace, removing the cross, and showing that they were bewitched. They were being fooled. They were not willing to change. As a result, they were distracted from their purpose. We understand distraction, don't we? Our world, our lives, oftentimes, very distracted. What's a good example of that? Well, any grocery store we walk into, gas station, workplace, school, park, name it, where a device is being used, you can see a mesmerization, almost as if in staring at the device, you could wave your hand in front of their face like this, and nothing would change the look. Now, I'm not saying that when the service is over, gather your devices up, we're going to do a bonfire in the back and throw them all in. That's not what I'm getting to. What I'm getting to is that we are a distracted people, and devices which were meant to help us possibly have become one of the largest distractions to believers. For instance, I was walking through the grocery store this week, had my cart, had my phone, walking along. What person did I see around me? Not one. I wasn't looking at a recipe. I'm not going to try to say, well, I was looking at the recipe and I was looking at my list. It wasn't that. I was staring at my phone, some type of a news feed or some type of a message or something, and I missed every person around me. In essence, here's what I did. I allowed this to take the place of this. Can you relate? And so what did I do with that? Did I recognize one need of any person around me? Facial expressions that one person was hurting? That one person may have needed their groceries purchased for him? One screaming kid was struggling and a parent maybe needed, hey, it's going to be okay. Nothing. Because I was here. Is it possible that we are so distracted, not in altering the gospel, as Paul was talking about, but something maybe even worse, missing the gospel altogether? If we're not seeing what's happening around us, we're not recognizing the opportunities that God puts right before us to be his hands and his feet and his mouth at points. Paul was trying to break into the trance, and the reason, because before their very eyes, Christ was publicly crucified. There's no historical recorded document that any of the Galatians were actually there, but when they surrendered their lives to Jesus, they encountered him. And it didn't come from their own works or their own actions or anything added to. It was Jesus. That was it. And now they've reverted back, and they've wanted to add things, Jesus plus. So that's what Paul reminds them of, what they've heard, seen, and accepted, but now they were bewitched, and in so doing became fools, verse 2. Let me ask you this. Did you receive the Spirit by works of the law or by hearing faith? Galatians 2:20, you don't have to look very far. It's the verse set right above this one, which was covered last week. I have been crucified with Christ. It is no longer I who live, but Christ who lives in me. If you surrendered your life to Jesus, that is a picture of who you are. The life I live in the flesh, I live by faith in the Son of God. So that what? So that what? Who loved me and gave himself for me, so that what? We can live in power. Strength. And the grace of God as we were called. He was trying to reason with them, saying, if they were saved when they were at their worst, how in the world could they add anything? Why were they now not accepted to the point that they would change the gospel and try to earn their way to salvation? It was ridiculous. Verse 3. Are you so foolish? Having begun by the Spirit, are you now being persecuted, perfected by the flesh? Are you now being perfected by the flesh? This verse focused on followers of Jesus growing and maturing. Oftentimes, when we're walking with God, relationally with him, intimate in relationship, we don't even recognize the growth that's happening in us. It's like this. Go back to when your kids were little. You may not be like me, for those of you who have kids, who often see your 10-year-old Ethan and 13-year-old as 5-year-olds. That is constantly what I do. When I see my kids, I at times see my 5-year-olds standing there. Great times when they were 5. But all of a sudden, I blink, and Ethan's this tall and asking if he can wear my shirts. And Tieran's like this tall and she's thinking college. And I'm like, where in the world did that happen? When did that take place? They've grown. I've been with them every day. But for whatever reason, there are parts of that I've missed. They grow so fast. Spiritually, what does that relate to? When we invest relationally with the Lord, what happens? God changes us. He grows us. At points, not even realizing it. We have a conversation with someone who's lost. Man, there's something going on. And the Spirit speaks through us, and we say things at times we don't even realize are in there. Or other believers who are struggling. I'm struggling with this area of my life. I need some encouragement. And the Spirit of God speaks and gives you words you didn't even know were there. What is that? That is the spiritual growth you've been missing, that you can't recognize in your own life because you're walking with them day in, day out. Can you relate to that? When was the last time God did that in your life? He speaks in and through us and to us and changes us in ways that he wants us to recognize, to give him glory and to be able to minister and challenge others to do the same. Verse 4. Did you suffer so many things in vain, if indeed it was in vain? Paul understood the concept of suffering. And he was telling the Galatians in that point, challenging them, asking them, listen, you've already suffered some things for the gospel because you claimed to have a relationship with Jesus. Why are you going backwards? Is it all for nothing? Is my investment for you and in you for nothing? Flip one page back or two pages back in your Bible to 2 Corinthians chapter 11. Just to confirm, Paul understood suffering. Look at verse 23 of chapter 11, 2 Corinthians. Are they servants of Christ? I'm a better one. He was giving an argument. I am talking like a madman with far greater labors, far more imprisonments, with countless beatings, and often near death. 5 times I received at the hands of the Jews the 40 lashes, less one. 3 times I was beaten with rods. Once I was stoned. 3 times I was shipwrecked. A night and a day I was adrift at open sea. On frequent journeys, in dangers from rivers, dangers from robbers, dangers from my own people, dangers from Gentiles, dangers in the city, dangers in the wilderness, dangers at sea, dangers from false brothers. Okay, so far I can relate to none of that. That is crazy suffering. Verse 27, in toil and hardship, through many sleepless nights, in hunger and thirst, often without food, in cold and exposure, and apart from other things, there is the daily pressure of my anxiety for all the churches. Okay, that's a point worth looking at too. Oftentimes we see our lives and ourselves as suffering servants. When I compare my life with Paul's, I see that my suffering is nothing like his. Not to mention that verse 28. He was that burdened for the church. Paul was that impassioned and burdened for the people that were a part of the Galatian church that he lost sleep and had extreme anxiety. When was the last time I asked myself that I was that burdened for Blue Valley Baptist Church? God, are we doing what we're supposed to be doing? Are we sharing the gospel? Are we making a difference? If this place was blown up tomorrow, would anyone care? Would the neighbors that are in our lots, the stores that are next to us, even realize it? Or would it be a big deal? Oh, my land, that church is gone. Those people are gone. They were the hands and feet of Christ to me. Or do they even know that we're here? That's a big question. Paul was burdened. How often am I burdened for the church like that? Sometimes. How long has it been? A while. What about you? When was the last time you were so burdened for Blue Valley Baptist Church to see God do something amazing and incredible of your church family and mine? You were overwhelmed with stress and anxiety because you didn't know if it was happening. And you had to take it to God. Please, God, do something here that's unusual. If it's been a while, maybe we need, come on, wake up. Slap out of it. Get into it. Let's go. Wake up. The time's short. We're not even promised tomorrow. Who is weak and I'm not weak? Man, I can relate to that. Who is made to fall and I am not indignant? But if I must boast, I will boast of the things that show my weakness. How many of us do that? We boast in our strengths. Paul understood suffering. Do we not in the same light? Or are burdens misplaced? Maybe. Paul was persecuted, and not only in Galatia, but everywhere and at every turn. And if he was persecuted, if we're following Jesus, will we be? Yeah. Boy, that's a great message to give to the lost. Hey, sign up for this deal. Surrender your life to Jesus, and guess what's coming? You're going to get blasted through the wall. It's going to be awesome. It's the reality and the truth of it. But that's a tough sell. So what's our saving piece of that? Matthew 5, 11 to 12. Blessed are you when others revile you and persecute you and utter all kinds of evil against you falsely on my account. Rejoice and be glad, for your reward is great in heaven. So not only do we get salvation, the one who loved us when no one else would, the one who died for us, the only one, by the way, who died for us, he vested himself for us, took our sin, gave us that opportunity. Our response back should be of such gratitude that our lives are carried out and live for him. But the reality is it's a struggle. And as we hold out the promise to the lost, we tell them, okay, what's the benefit? One, that you know the God of the universe personally. Two, you've got an awesome eternity coming. Three, you don't have to wait. It starts now. Blessed are you. In standing for and sharing the gospel and living it out, suffering and persecution are a part. But the blessing in that is that we can know God. That's big time. John 10:10. The thief comes only to do three things: steal, kill, and destroy. We don't need to be under the illusion that Satan's this TV character that's after the good for people. He's not. He's our enemy. He hates us. He wants to destroy us. Is it evidence in our lives and in our world? Absolutely. He wreaks havoc. He hates our every being. And he wants us to live in defeat. But God has called us to better than that. What did Jesus say at the end of that verse? But I have come that they may have life and have it to the full. You ever see a person, student or adult, that you realize they're not experiencing the fullness of God in their lives? You can see it by expression. You talk to them, you talk about spiritual things to them, and it's just like there's a glaze. And you talk about the reality of God in your own life to believers, then it's just like, I have no idea what you're talking about. Because they're not experienced in that way. Are we praying for them? Are we encouraging them? Are we them? And if so, what needs to change in us? How can we reach out to those who need that? Next verse, 5. Does he who supplies the Spirit to you and works miracles among you do so by works of the law or by hearing with faith? We don't talk about miracles very much in the Baptist church. Why? Because they've been so abused in our world and stories of made up things that have happened that we're afraid to. But what are the real miracles? Restored marriage? Boom, miracle. Someone finds Christ. JP, who you're going to see a picture of at the end of the service, Found Christ, Ridgeview Campus, boom, miracle. God changes one thing in our lives and hearts that makes it more directed to him. Boom, miracle, baby. Why are we telling those stories? No wonder everyone's looking down and wondering what's going on and why we don't have purpose. Let's share them. It's an encouragement to hear stories of how God works in us and how he's changing us. Why are we missing it? We can do better. I can do better. Verse 6, just as Abraham believed God, it was counted to him as righteousness. Abraham was saved by faith. The point Paul here was making was the solution was given before the problem was even shown to man. God saved Abraham, not by the law, but by faith alone in grace that came alone in Christ Jesus. Verse 7, know then that it is those of faith who are sons of Abraham. The Jews believed they would be saved because of being established as God's chosen people. Some believe they are followers because their family line were followers. Some believe they're followers because they're good people. But the gospel tells us the opposite. We are followers, become followers when we surrender our lives to the one who gave his life for us. When God sees us, he sees either the blood of Jesus covering our lives or not. That's it. How does he see you today? Verse 7. Know then that it is those of faith who are sons of Abraham. The Jews believed they would be saved because they were God's chosen people. Important for us to get is salvation by grace through faith. Verse 8. And the scripture, foreseeing that God would justify the Gentiles by faith, preached the gospel before Abraham, saying, in you shall all the nations be blessed. Paul is once again stating that we need to remember so that we don't fall away or try to alter in some form or fashion. Where were you when you were saved? Do you remember the moment? What has God done in your life since then? I was saved at Mike Brewster's house, age 15, hot dog roast hayride. I remember it. God did a radical work in my life, continues to do radical works in my life. Where were you? Paul was reminding them, remember where you were, who you were, and what he did. Don't go back to the law. Don't go back to adding. He wants an ongoing, moment-by-moment relationship with us that lives out what took place in our lives. Verse 9, so then, those who are of faith are blessed along with Abraham, the man of faith. I'm going to read two quotes. They're split, a little commentary in between. Matt Chandler said this, related to this passage. The opposite of love is not hate. The opposite of love is indifference. Okay, guilty. So to see someone you love get off the rails and be on a crash course, a collision course with their own destruction, and to do nothing or to just hope it works out is a supremely unloving act. At Disciple Now, every year, leaders go back with the students and spend one-on-one time with them. It's awesome. I'd like to get a one-on-one with those leaders so that they could talk to me. It's a beautiful opportunity. They present hard truths to the students in that based on what they filled out on their sheets and challenging them. Listen, you're heading towards destruction. You're in trouble. And they get a mixed reaction. Some respond and follow. Some don't. The word is given from this pulpit every week. Sunday school classrooms every week. And there are parts of those messages of the gospel, of the word that come out that are supposed to change our direction. At times, it sinks in, it hits, we do it. At times, it doesn't. But at least there are voices in our lives that show the opposite of indifference, which is love. What we have seen thus far in Galatians is Paul reaching out to the people he loved with all of his life and trying to bring them back once again to the point of calling those he once referred to as brothers as foolish, trying to get their attention. Second quote, Matt Chandler gave this, it is snatching them out of trouble, speaking of children in the street with cars coming. It is snatching them out of trouble, like pulling a kid out of the street and saying, have you lost your mind? Come, look at the dead squirrel. Look at that. Do you know how easily that could have been you? Don't run into the street. Come on, buddy. Isn't that what we would all do if we saw a kid heading to the street with crazy cars, scream at the top of our lungs, get out of the street? This week at Panera Bread, I had that opportunity. Panera Bread Lenexa, if you've been over there before, you know what that front is like. It's a storefront. There's a hardware store, Panera, lots of stores. The parking lot is crazy. I hate that parking lot. I never know where to park. And traveling in between the aisles is almost, it seems impossible. I can't get the system down. So I drove really carefully through the parking lot, thought, okay, where do I need to park where my car doesn't get hit? Went up, got in a spot, secured, everything's okay, got out, walked up. Well, in front of the hardware store, there were some people making hot dogs and some kind of a fundraiser. You guys have seen that all over the place. Those happen. So they're making hot dogs, and I see this elderly gentleman come out of the hardware store. And so he starts tooting along, gives his pleasantries. Hey, you guys have a good day. Super nice guy, it seemed. He was talking to the workers and went over to his vehicle, got in, handicapped, right in front of the store, handicapped parking spot. Looked both ways, looked in the rear view, looked in his rear views again, put it in reverse, and started. Well, behind him, there are cars that travel that road. And so he would have to back into an area where cars are going. So what's the spot called behind a person when they can't see? Oh, boom, blind spot. There it is. So he looks behind, and for you Corvette owners, lovers, this is going to be horrific. Corvette black, right here, right in this blind spot, three cars right in front of him. Well, he saw the three cars, it was obvious, but he didn't see the black vet of the upper 50s, lower 60s guy right behind him. So what does he do? Reverse, starts backing up. Real slow, very careful, super slow. So there are five people standing here watching the whole thing happen that were making hot dogs, watching the whole thing. Other people walking, seeing everything happen. And here I am. You know me well enough by now. I saw it going on. I was, stop! I started yelling because I was afraid he was going to back in to the Corvette. And no retired individual, especially a sweet man like that guy, wanted to get in an accident. You know, that brings lots of bad things. So I start yelling, stop! Stop! Don't go any further! And I start running towards the car. Not fast enough. And he backed into the vet. I was like, oh, man, five more seconds. That's all I needed. Gets out of the car. Oh, no. He's upset. The guy with the vet, he's not mad. He's upset. He saw who hit him. Oh, no. Here come the insurance cards, taking care of it. And I was just like, dang it, I almost got there. Who in our lives needs us to start yelling, stop! You're heading down a road to destruction. Followers of Jesus, we know. You're making wrong choices. Lost people, stop. You're dying and going to hell. But oftentimes, we're either frozen like those workers, we're so indifferent, we do nothing. You may be in the room today where you need to stop and see Jesus. If that's you, I'm begging you, respond to him today. Because you're heading down a road that will only bring trouble and destruction. And God has better for you than that. If you're lost and you're here today, what is the reason that you are here? To find Jesus today. This is your stop. This is it. Will you find him? Points. Number one, the Christian life begins by faith. We've talked about it. Number two, the Christian life is completed by faith. One day it will be. How are you doing today?